Hello everyone, welcome back. We're coming to the end of season two soon, and what a season it's been. Season two, episode 17. Last week's episode, if you haven't listened to it, featured the absolutely fantastic George Mycock, the founder of Myo Minds, and it was an episode on eating disorders and compulsive exercise disorders. And George and I shared our own personal experiences of how body dysmorphia can have a huge impact on your life. If you feel like you're suffering or you're struggling with the way you look and how you yourself perceive the way you look, give it a listen. I think we cover a lot of important subjects. I also want to give a huge, huge shout out to somebody who emailed us this week. He's had a very, very tough time very recently with some brutal family tragedies, including the loss of his brother to suicide. He got in touch with us to say how he's had to drag himself out of some very, very, very dark holes recently. But the reason why I'm sharing this is because in the email, there was a distinct message of hope. It does get better, he said. He's an avid listener of this podcast, and it's made him realise that he's really not alone in his battles. So, Dan from Sydney, here's a shout out to you, mate. Hang in there, stay safe, and look after your wonderful other half. And thank you so much for your beautiful, beautiful email. This week, I am going to welcome an extraordinary human being to the podcast. Many of you won't know him, but Alex Staniforth is a record-breaking adventurer, ultra-endurance athlete, international motivational speaker, author, and mental health activist. All at the age of 25. Yes, 25. Alex's story hasn't really always been that rosy, though. He got into extreme challenges and adventures because he was bullied at school, he suffered with epilepsy, he suffered brutal depression, and still challenges and battles with eating disorders that affect his day-to-day life. However, this man knows a thing or two about overcoming adversity, and that is why I wanted to have him on the podcast. Having experienced the two biggest consecutive disasters in Mount Everest history, including the 2015 Nepal earthquake, which trapped him on the mountain for 2 days, just let that sink in. In July 2017, he became the fastest person ever to climb all 100 UK county tops and won the Pride of Britain Granada Report's Fundraiser of the Year in 2017. In 2020, he ran the National Three Peaks Challenge, covering 452 miles in just 9 days and 12 hours. 9 days and 12 hours, 452 miles. Having suffered with his mental health challenges since a teenager, he then also has co-founded Mind Over Mountains, a mental health charity to help others restore mental well-being naturally through outdoor experiences. If you're looking for reading material, Alex is the author of 2 books. Icefall, which is the true story of his attempts at Everest, and by the way, he tried to attempt Everest at the age of 18 years old. So I highly recommend giving that a read. I've read it. It's utterly, utterly fantastic. He's also author of Another Peak, the story of his record-breaking challenge to climb all 100 UK tops. So, Alex Staniforth, it is an absolute pleasure to welcome you to The Rut. As always, please leave all judgment at the door.
Alex, how are you?
Good to welcome you to the Rut.
Yeah, well, hi James, great to be here. Yeah, thank you for the chance just to talk, to talk and offload some of the the challenges at the moment. Really, it's great to be here and talking about something that's, I think, is is a really important subject. So I'm okay. I think as we spoke just now, it's been a challenging week. So this has been quite well timed. I'm on, I'm always in the peaks and troughs at the moment. I'm in a rut or a trough, if you like. So I'm just trying to manage that as best I can. And talking about it is one way. So yeah, thank you for having me.
Do you know what? That's the perfect introduction to the episode, because to me, you're my age, so 25, 26, and you're one of the most remarkable 25-year-olds I've had the pleasure of coming across, purely because of your story. And to know, I'm so excited to explore this you in this next hour, or however long it is. But you just saying there, you're in a rut and you're looking forward to talking about it is just brilliant. So thank you for being so open early doors. I obviously got in contact with you because I wanted to explore how you've overcome adversity, because we're recording a mini series for the Rut right now, which is exploring what I call the Rut superhumans, these type of people who have gone through things in their life but have also done amazing things in the face of adversity. Now we'll get on to your story in a sec, but apart from me reaching out, why did you want to come on the podcast?
I mean, mental health has been an area of interest to me for a few years now. I think I've started to embrace it as part of my journey more than I used to. I think as a man and as an athlete, that's presented its own challenges, especially having an eating disorder. There's a lot of talk about mental health and it can almost be a bit overwhelming sometimes. But I think actually men's mental health and eating disorders in particular is still a bit niche and still a bit unexplored. So I'm very open to talking about it. And I think that it was listening to other people's stories that helped me to open up and ultimately, deal with my own challenges a lot more than I used to. And I think that is a really key step for all of us to maintain our mental health. So if I can help other people to do the same by sharing my story, honestly, then that's what motivates me. And I think especially people may see me as somebody that's, successful or, I've got lots of things going well, but actually I think it's important to show that we all have our challenges and that I have my bad days as much as anybody. There's this whole idea of strength, and especially in the athlete and the adventure of the outdoor world, you might have that image of kind of so-called strength. But I think it's really important to be vulnerable, and we all have a right to be, we'll have an obligation to share that. So if I can share my story and also to raise awareness about, my new project, Minor Mountains, as well, is a great opportunity.
Awesome. Well, look, thank you very, very much for sharing it all. You've got an amazing story. Take me back to the Alex Staniforth at school who found out he had epilepsy at the age of 9, and then went on this journey. I would call it a journey because I've been on a similar journey to you, albeit I don't have epilepsy, but of bullying and taking on various different belief systems about yourself that aren't true, but you took them on as your person anyway.
Take you back to that. I mean, so I'm 25 now, but really it was started when I was at school, if not before that. I mean, I had a very fairly normal upbringing. I was brought up in Chester. I was an only child. Parents gave me a great start, everything I needed. Ever since I could speak, I had a stammer, which I still have. It's very much still an ongoing challenge. But made school very difficult and was unable to really express myself properly from a young age. I think that was when any kind of confidence issues and anxiety started. I had epilepsy when I was about 9. It was only a very mild form. I had a handful of seizures and it was brought under control with, on medication. I've not had a seizure since. I'm very lucky. I don't really say that I have epilepsy anymore. But actually, it was what that caused that was the problem. Having seizures and then all the medical tests and all that procedure caused anxiety and panic attacks. You know, it yep. shattered my confidence from a young age. You know, I was learning to manage panic attacks, and I was afraid of being out of the house without my parents in case I had another seizure. And, you know, being out on parties or being at school, being around with my friends was just a really unsettling experience. And I didn't really have many places where I felt safe. Combine that with the stammer, I've been, you know, relentlessly bullied throughout my entire time at school. You know, my kind of self-esteem, my self-worth wasn't particularly high. I hated sport. You know, I wasn't very physically minded at all. I was the one that kind of came last at sports day, you know, PE. I guess if you put all these things together, you know, I didn't really have a lot going for me. You know, I believed I was born to fail. Mm. I was very academic. You know, I was always quite bright, and, you know, I was successful in that sense, but I never really fitted in and never really had the sort of drive that I have now at all. I think really...
Sorry to interrupt. The bullying complex, or the bullying you experienced, it does produce a lot of limiting belief systems, right? And so from feeling of rejection, not being loved, even though you receive all the love in the world from your parents, etc., but actually when you're rejected by your friends early doors, it's really difficult. But also this whole feeling of not quite feeling good enough. What kind of belief system did you take on? How did it manifest itself?
I think mostly it was actually being very much a high achiever, a perfectionist. That sense of like never accepting good enough, and in everything I did, like my schoolwork and just my everything I did, you know, I beat myself up over mistakes. Very, very self-critical. And unrealistic expectations, really, you know, because I kind of wanted to be better than other people because I'd always been made to feel the worst. I think that's a key lesson itself, is that nobody can make you feel anything, you know, but at the time, obviously, it's easier said than done. So I think I started to almost mask it by trying to fit in, maybe not really being myself, you know, trying to be with the cool kids, so to speak. But I think the belief system at the time was I was just not being authentic. I wasn't really being myself. And it started to get better towards the end of school, but I wasn't really following my real path until I found the outdoors. But yeah, there is that. I think really the main trait was just that kind of very self-critical. And even today, that's still an ongoing challenge. Oh, yeah. Ultimately, is what drives me in my outdoor challenges is that when I'm in the outdoors or, you know, on a mountain or whatever, it's just me versus the environment. You know, no bully can stop that.
Mm. That's really interesting. We get to, as you describe it, a fateful encounter with paragliding on holiday, age 13, which unearthed this passion for the outdoors. How did that passion grow and to the point where you are aged really, well, 17, you do a number of different challenges after this paragliding experience, and then you find yourself about to summit Everest. I mean, what's the story there?
Yeah, very bizarre one, I guess. I mean, I was on holiday with my mum in Turkey, and you know, I was still at high school, and you know, I just started to almost find a bit of a passion for kind of nature and the outdoors, but not so much sports. I'd started cycling to school every day for about, well, pretty much till the day I left, which I started because there were bullies in the school bus. You know, I was sick to death of that, so I thought, well, I'll just cycle. So I was cycling 10 miles to school every single day, rain or shine. Then I had my bike tyre slashed and I was spat on and bottles thrown at me instead, so I couldn't really escape. But back to that moment on holiday, I don't really know where the urge came from. I just kind of saw this thing advertised and thought, I've got to do this. You know, I'd always had a bit of interest. My dad had been a marathon runner. He'd done quite a few adventurous sports. So he was inspired me as well. But I just kind of had this almost higher calling, and it's hard to pinpoint, you know. I thought, I've got to do this. You know, I'm fed up of being held back by my beliefs and what other people think of me and the epilepsy and everything else. And I'd scared the living daylights of myself. You know, I'd never done anything like this. My mum looked at me like I'd gone mad. You know, where has this come from? But that decision, you know, embracing that fear, I think accountability, you know, putting yourself in a position where you kind of sign up and you've got to do it. I think it's all about a mindset shift. Because when I did that jump, God, I've never felt fear like it. But there was something in me that spurred me towards it. And I think once you've got that experience behind you, that becomes your reference point. Instead of thinking, oh, I can't do that because of this, because of that, actually, I've done that, so I can do this. It sounds incredibly simple, but it is simple mindset, a mindset shift from this kind of victim mindset to a victory mindset. So after that paragliding flight, I was like, right, what else can I overcome? What else can I do? And sure, I still have my difficult days. You know, I still have frustrations, but I kind of realized I wasn't afraid to be different anymore. I didn't need to fit in, and I wanted to follow my own path. I lost everything in common with my friends. I wasn't interested. I just wanted to follow this outdoor passion. So I was looking for more things I could do, you know, what else I could kind of surprise myself with. The anxiety really improved. Everything improved. And, except my school grades, because I just lost interest in school.
Right.
Because I realized then that it was shortly after that I was invited hill walking in the Lake District with my friend and his family. Something I'd never really done before. And I wasn't like completely obsessed with the outdoors by that point. You know, I just remember going along and I'm still really struggling with anxiety. I remember just going for a meal that night and just like my health anxiety was so bad because of the epilepsy that I thought having a chocolate cake, I was going to have a panic attack. You know, it was right. That bad. But that day in the hills kind of inspired this question of where is Mount Everest? You know, I didn't know anything about it. I don't really know where that question came from. But naturally, as you do, I went home, went on Google, typed in, you know, Mount Everest and saw this photo. And I just became completely fascinated, captivated. And it just kind of made me realize, you know, this is the biggest thing I could achieve, the biggest thing I could overcome after the epilepsy and everything else. And realizing that one day I had to do this, you know, this is kind of my calling. This is all that mattered to me. And I think really in some ways, all the bullying was quite a good driver because once I committed to myself, I felt like giving up or failing was kind of giving in to the bullies. I felt like this was my chance to really make or break, you know?
Yeah. I was going to ask you, it was clear at a young age that you were forming this extraordinary mindset in every sense of the word, extraordinary, around challenges. Was there a desire to prove the bullies wrong? Because in essence, yeah, not feeling good enough, you were like, do you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to feel good enough here and I'm going to stick two fingers up to you.
It was about proving myself and the bullies wrong. You know, I wanted to prove myself wrong more than anything. And it's been interesting, the last few years, I found that I haven't really got anything to prove anymore, only to myself. But the challenges have taken on a different meaning recently. I think at the time it was about that. And it was like a case of commitment and accountability. Accountability to myself, because if I gave up, I only had myself to blame. I couldn't blame the bullies anymore. I couldn't blame the epilepsy. And so really, I just put a plan in place. You know, I've always been quite pragmatic. And I think I've been quite mature for my age because of what I've been through and my parents, you know, they split up just as I started high school, which kind of was a really unsettling experience. I think that from then on, it was a case of finding out what steps I had to take. You know, I booked onto a rock climbing course in Keswick in the lakes where I'd been on the hill walk because I was just desperate to go back. Climbed with an Everest expedition leader and, you know, prized him with questions all day. I was just like obsessed with it, with this big mountain. And it just had this kind of superhuman, supernatural feel to it, you know. But then after that, you know, I started to kind of, you know, half-heartedly take steps towards it. So I climbed Mont Blanc. But actually, no, before that, I climbed the Three Peaks in the normal way when I was 16, which at the time was like my biggest thing I'd ever done. And it's crazy to think about what I'm about to try and do soon, but I'll come on to that shortly. And it's kind of constantly, I think, about just stretch. You know, you're stretching the bar, you're building that experience, that confidence of, yes, I can do that, and I can do that much, and a bit more. And then it was Mont Blanc. You know, the Alps was my first sort of step. But again, that's only half the height of Everest. this had all been funded by working in a kitchen, you know, literally pot washing, nothing more glamorous than that. You know, and a bit of sponsorship and things. But I'd never really been interested in the typical stuff. So I wasn't interested in kind of socializing and, you know, going out with friends. I focused entirely on this. I think that was what made it possible, was being willing to commit 100%. After Mont Blanc, there was then a peak in the Himalayas called Burundi. But actually, before I jump ahead of the story, it was interesting because I got into running and became my obsession. You know, I just loved it. I was racing 10K and half marathons. And then I suffered depression for the first time at the end of 2011. Sounds interesting, but I think it was actually because I got dumped by my first and only girlfriend. Something I'd never dealt with before. And it just freed me for six. So
what does depression look like to you?
At that time, what was difficult was I'd never felt anything like it, so it was quite startling. It's just this kind of hopelessness. Like there's nothing to get you out of it, and a sense of kind of helplessness.
If we take depression and you look back at and you reflect back on the moments that actually depression has taken control of you, not just the age of 11, because I appreciate that that's a young age to obviously feel hopelessness, but moving forward, obviously what we've not quite touched on just yet is eating disorders and depression as that's growing through as a teen. I'm just interested to know, like, what depression in your ruts looks like.
For me, depression's probably been less of the issue. I've always had it quite mildly. It's always resolved fairly quickly. But that was the first kind of, I was 16 at the time. And I think it was the first kind of diagnosed depression I'd had. Before that, it'd just been anxiety and panic attacks, which I got better at managing as I got older, you know, and still have to manage them today. With depression at the time, it was just this kind of hopelessness and loss of control.
Yes.
And so I found that in running, you know, and this is where my kind of passion for running and fitness came from. The following year, this was when I climbed Mont Blanc. I had the focus. Having that purpose is what got me out of it. And this is where I think it changed, because that year I carried the Olympic torch in Chester, which was like a massive honour for my fundraising I'd done for charity from Mont Blanc and for the Three Peaks. And that was when I kind of got a bit of recognition, like, crikey, if I keep on doing these things, it's going to take me on a really rewarding path in life. Yeah, this is great. But then I got injured that year. I couldn't run. I couldn't cycle. And so I'd almost lost that escape again and lost that sense of purpose. And at that point, Everest was loosely a goal in mind. But it was kind of, you know, it happened one day type thing. Towards the end of that year, you know, once Mont Blanc had kind of been and went and the Olympic torch had died down, the depression just got worse and worse. And I think a lot of it was triggered by the frustration of being unable to run and unable to get out. And it was just, it's always very hard to pinpoint. And for me, it's more a case of that I'm quite high functioning. You know, I can keep on working and doing things with it. I can learn to push through it. But it's just, there's no feeling, there's no hope, there's no sense of anything to look forward to. And when you have nothing to look forward to, the world's a pretty dark place. And because of the injury, you know, again, because of this kind of high achieving perfectionist mindset, naturally, you know, I thought, okay, what can I do about it? So I thought, well, I'll try and focus on my nutrition to make me a better runner when I come back from the injury, because it wasn't anything serious, but it went on for a long time. It was just an undiagnosed pain in my shins, which actually ended up being a growth spurt, because I mean I'm 6'4" now, so it's just been because of a growth spurt, which is annoying.
You're lucky. I'm 5'6" and haven't had a growth spurt since I was about 14, so
it has pros and cons. But I think at the time, you know, I thought, okay, well, I will focus on nutrition. But again, naturally, I set my standards very high. And I was cutting out bad foods and such, you know, that I'd researched. So that I was having this healthy, perfect athlete diet, not to lose weight, just for performance. But naturally, these boundaries were too high. They failed. And, you know, I found myself working in the kitchen, which didn't help because I'm surrounded by junk food. And naturally, I started to binge, you know, I just started to actually binge just to kind of comfort eat from all the frustration I felt. But then there was the kind of panic about weight gain and health and everything like that. And then that's, you know, it was towards the end of that year, you know, that's actually, you know, that's probably when the eating disorder started. So it was binge eating, then bulimia, because then that was almost the breakthrough was, oh, I can have my cake and eat it. But I didn't realize.
It's a vicious cycle, really. Tape eating and then, yeah.
I didn't realize at the time that actually this idea of improving my nutrition had actually been the unhealthiest thing I possibly ever could have done, because 8 years later, I'm still paying the consequences for that.
In what sense?
I've never seen food in the same way since. You know,
wow.
That's, once you get that, as you say, it's a vicious cycle, because when you can binge eat and eat unhealthily, suddenly you lose that balance. You've given that, when you create that way of almost, you know, undoing the damage by, you know, by binge eating or, you know, or then purging it in, you know, in a sense of bulimia, you create a really unhealthy relationship with food.
Of course.
You know, we all enjoy a bit of indulgence, but when you can't limit or monitor that, it's changed things forever, you know. And
you said you can't see food in the same way. How do you see it now?
At the moment, it's been fairly stable. You know, I've made a lot of progress last year. You know, that was actually through you know, actually more therapy. And then this year, with my training, you know, when I'm able to train at a good level and I'm running and I'm active, I can manage it very well. But I realised that I was under fueling, so I had to eat a lot more, which has actually been okay. But at the moment, it's a lot better now, but at its worst, it was a case of I couldn't be around, you know, like a buffet or any unlimited food, because I'd binge and purge. I couldn't have anything in excess in the house, because, well, you know, when I was on my own, I would just turn to that. Or with any emotional discomfort or low feelings, instead of depression, I'd kind of turn to the food instead. But it also,
how did it feel? Because you obviously knew, right? You knew that this was a really difficult situation you're finding yourself in, right? You know that you, once you get an urge, it's going to cause you pain. So how did that feel?
It's the most confusing, disgusting, guilty, just bewildering feeling. Because you know it's bad for you. You know you're going to feel worse and you keep doing it anyway. This is the thing, is that even when I got back to sport, I thought it would just disappear. And it improved, because I could use sport as a motivation not to, and also to feel better about myself. When injuries come in, or when I lose purpose in general, you know, that's the vulnerability. But I think really it's that case of, once you've created that vicious cycle, it's very hard to break. And the best way to describe it, somebody said to me, is it's like, you know, it's just the same as alcohol addiction. The thing is you need food to survive. And I think really for what it's been the last few years, as I've been getting the hang of it, is it's been more about having to avoid certain triggers or avoid situations. But that's not living. You know, you don't want to be doing that. Obviously, you have to put health first. But I've always enjoyed food. I've always been fed well. Well, you know, if that means anything. But it's that case of lack of balance, and it's self-sabotaging, really. You know, I've never been overweight or anything, but it's that case of control with food. I think that's where it manifests itself. And to be able to maintain that healthily now, I have to very rigidly plan all my meals and calories. And if something throws me, it can be very difficult to kind of stay in a healthy routine. But for the last year or so, though, I've made a lot of progress in that. But last year was probably the most challenging of my life, not so much with depression, but the eating disorder itself, almost, it becomes an obsession. You know, it can take over your thoughts, to the point that when I was going to events, you know, going to work, I was more interested in what was in the lunch buffet than what I was there to do. It's horrible, really.
I want to come on to Everest and the actual challenges, and explore the psychology of dealing with that level of physical adversity. But I also, as somebody who has clearly sat there with therapists and himself
and being able to be incredibly self-aware, understand the triggers, but also has beaten a lot of often I've got under control the limiting belief systems. And when I spoke to, when I have gone through my therapy on a variety of different issues, the one thing my therapist has spoken quite passionately about with me is limiting belief systems. Let's say you're not feeling good enough or not loved or rejection, whatever it might be, is a conversation you're having in your mind. It's a voice in your head telling you these things because it's how you see your narrative of the world. This is how your sum of experiences manifests itself into daily life. How have you been able to transcend that conversation in your mind? The little nagging things that come up often day to day, but when you're thinking, right, okay, I'm going to go and do something crazy like you've done with the client in the UK, et cetera, we'll get onto that in a bit. But like that conversation in mind, how have you worked around that?
Which way in particular? Sorry. So, yeah, sorry to explain that a bit more. So you mean the conversations with actually, you know, with myself or therapies or, you know,
No, conversation with yourself. Because there's only so much therapy can really do. It's also taking ownership and practice makes perfect with therapy as well, with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, therapy, to be honest, only really helped me last year. Before that, everything I tried never really got. And I think ultimately it's very easy to get yourself in that position when everything's going well and you're fine, you just kind of distract yourself from it, you sweep under the rug. But ultimately when things are going well, you know, I almost don't need to have the conversations. It's almost when things are going bad and I'm feeling very much overwhelmed and feeling very negative about myself. I'm very much my own worst enemy. You know, I catch myself just grinding myself down and saying all sorts of things to try and offload it. But I think really it's bizarre because I know I've been through worse, you know, and actually those outdoor experiences have given me that hope that actually, crikey, when this is really, really bad and I can't see the top of the mountain, if I can survive what I have on Everest and the other mountains, then actually I've got some resilience in me somewhere to get through this. And I think that's kind of the conversations I have to have. But I catch myself all the time, even recently, just beating myself to the ground, you know, mentally. I'm sure we all have these horrible voices and we come up with all sorts of bizarre possibilities and scenarios that probably aren't going to happen. And then a week later, we think, crikey, what was on about last week? So if that answers, I'm not sure if I'm on the right lines here. But
no, you are. I just find it interesting because with anxiety, having suffered with it myself, is this need to understand that your thoughts are kind of just thoughts. They're actually not reality. And so, for me, and I think a lot of people listening will feel like, they're not kind of being their true self. That's what they're told to be. They're told to do certain things because society dictates, but with what you've done with your challenges, you've been able to step away from that kind of crowd. Your own destiny is in your control. And actually, when you're not really in control, that's when your mental health struggles. But also interested to understand how you think about your thoughts. That might be quite a weird way to phrase it, but they are just thoughts.
Interesting question. I think, and as a thought, you know, it's bizarre because a lot of these beliefs are, you know, they aren't based on evidence. A lot of anxieties, you know, they're not based on evidence, and things happen and you can convince yourself that this time's different, this time is when it is going to go bad, and then you almost start to catch yourself with the spiral effects, and it's like going and it's almost running ahead of itself. I often call it, you know, the chimp, you know, you just sort of grab it and pull it back around the ear and actually think, right, what is the reality? What are the facts? What can I deal with now? So I think it's just knowing for me with that they'll pass, you know, these criticisms, these sort of negative thinking, it's easy to add meaning to them when there is no meaning. You know, whether that's somebody saying something bad or something bad happening, you start to think, oh, this is happening against me. You know, you almost become that victim kind of mindset. And I think experience has taught me that actually it's more about, you know, actually, you know, how we think about it ultimately determines the outcome. You can think about it as, oh, you know, poor me, I'm a victim, this is really bad, this is going to happen. And or you can think about it in a different way. The outcome's going to be different. The scenario is the same. But equally, I think it is easy to be misdrew by the facts and what's, you know, what's actually not real. And ultimately, to know things can change very, very quickly. And then you can almost look back at yourself in a week and think, crikey, what was I on about? You know, and and just know that thoughts are always passing, and just to let them pass, I think is it's me. But I think I've always been at that kind of intense angle that I tend to be on the peak or on the trough. And always analysing things quite a lot. So looking at where thoughts are coming from. And when I'm looking for advice or reassurance, it's not looking for the people you're going to ask. Because if you ask certain people, well, you're just going to get a reflection of them and their path. And I think, well, is that the path I want to be going on? I think it's almost having your own confidence and single-mindedness to an extent, not to ignore help, but to know what you need.
Moving on to Everest, because this is an amazing story, and then moving into climb the UK and Three Peaks and exploring adversity. First thing I'm so interested is, how do you define adversity?
A challenge to be overcome.
Mm.
I think people can see adversity as a problem, but I see it as a challenge. You know, a problem means you don't have to do anything about it, but a challenge is it's a response, you know.
Mm. And actually, you're one of your first challenges, even before you'd step foot on Everest, even before you step foot in base camp, was raising money. I heard it was like 35 grand that you had to raise, and you were what, 17, 18 years old, just leaving school.
Yeah, I was still doing my A-levels, 16, 17. Didn't do very well on my A-levels as a result, but I still passed them. But I'd given up on school at that point. I didn't want to follow that beaten path. I dropped out of university. Well, I was on a kind of a cap year as such, but I dropped out whilst trekking down from base camp after the first avalanche, having decided it wasn't for me. So glad I did that. Raising the money, though, was a full-time job. You know, I was washing pots just to kind of pay my keep.
Absolutely,
I didn't really have anything else to spend on. I didn't have a social life. I just, every single day of the week was spent on Everest. But, you know, it got me there. So it felt very much impossible.
I listened to a podcast you did. I listened to the podcast you did with Ben Shepherd recently, in which you said something very nice, actually. He said, if you don't believe in yourself 100%, you're almost guaranteed to fail. Now, with everything you've been through mentally in the previous years, building up to even stepping foot on Everest and then raising that money, what advice do you have, or what can you kind of share to people who struggle with confidence and self-belief to basically go and do whatever the fuck they want?
Well, it's a bit of a cliche to say, well, I can do it, so you can do it too. But I think ultimately I was driven by a fear of failure, by a fear of going back to where I was and almost being proven wrong, you know, which isn't necessarily a good driver to have, because you've got to have it. You've got to want it for yourself if you want to have that sense of satisfaction. Otherwise, you're never going to get there if you're constantly trying to prove something to other people. But I think ultimately we are capable of so much more than we think. But I often hear people saying to me, oh, well, it just wasn't meant to be. And that to me saddens me, because I think that's just an excuse for giving up too soon. You know, for me, with that goal with Everest and sponsorship, you know, I had to contact over 1,000 companies, you know, emailing them day in and day out to the early hours of the morning. People tried to doubt me, and I doubted myself many more times. But it's been able to ignore that and just to keep on going that next step. Every time you get a rejection, knowing that it will come, and knowing that if you don't believe in yourself when you speak to people, people will pick up on that. And be very careful who you listen to, because if they haven't achieved something of the same scale, well, maybe there's a reason for that. And their beliefs and mindsets are going to probably take you to the same place. I think ultimately to know as well that, when people are saying that, I think it is more of an excuse, whereas actually it's with the setbacks, with the adversity, how you can respond to that, I think is ultimately what got me to Everest and to other things. When a lot of people would naturally default to just to call it a day and do something else. But ultimately I think we attach that meaning rather than it being the meaning, if that makes sense.
Just to set the scene for people listening or watching, we're talking about a 18-year-old Alex Staniforth, right? 17, 18? That 18 first attempt? 18 in the first. We're talking about an 18-year-old attempting to summit Everest. Now, you had two attempts, right? 2014 and 2015. Both ended in, well, tragedy, really. What the fuck happened?
Good question. The two biggest disasters in Everest history. Two consecutive years. First year, we were just a day before we got to base camp. There was a big avalanche in the icefall, which tragically killed 16 Sherpas. So pretty much obviously couldn't climb. So raised the money again, had another year of training, went back in 2015. Same team, same format. We were actually climbing. You know, we started to make some progress, and we were just below camp one. We'd moving through the icefall. When an earthquake hit Nepal, the 2015 earthquake, which tragically killed over 9,000 people. Now, at the time of the mountain, you know, I was so knackered that I didn't even feel it. But ultimately, our team were hit by a big powder avalanche in the icefall. Most of the team were already at camp one at this point, which is about 6,000 meters, about the same height of Kilimanjaro. We were stuck on the mountain for 2 days, fortunately unharmed. We didn't know actually that down below base camp had just been wiped out, you know, by a much bigger avalanche triggered by the earthquake. And, you know, our home on the mountain and just it gone.
So, take me back to being those 2 days where you're kind of in the middle, really, of obviously stage two and base camp. Base camp's just been wiped out, and I presume you heard what happened.
We didn't, to be honest. I mean, after the shock of the actual avalanche that hit us, I mean, luckily it was only miles. You know, when that happened, I was on my own at the point, and I was thinking, this is it. This is how I die. You know, at 19, this was game over. And that itself is a very sickening feeling that I can't really describe. But actually, when we were stuck at camp one, we were getting hit by aftershocks and avalanches and everything. We didn't know how long we're going to be there. We were stuck for 2 days, we'll be there for a week. We've only got food and water for maybe a day or two at most.
What's going through your head?
I was just in shock because we didn't know what had happened. We got on the radio down to base camp and we heard Henry, our base camp manager, just saying, base camp's gone. You know, it's chaos, it's devastation, it's gone. And we're like, where's it gone? How's base camp gone? And basically, you know, we couldn't picture or visualize what had happened. We didn't even know what had happened at this point until we flew down by helicopter that was our only option 2 days later to find what was like a plane crash. You know, we had no idea, but actually that first night we heard that three of our team had sadly died. So we're all trying to put the pieces together as to how had they died. What on earth was going on? As we were just cut off from the outside world.
What were the emotions?
At the time, just shock, disbelief. You know, didn't really know what was going on. Just lay there for 2 days, really, basically in shock.
Oh my God.
Couldn't eat or drink, couldn't do anything. And some team must have handled it a lot better than I did, you know. But it didn't feel that bad at the time because it almost felt like a dream. I think you're kind of in like survival mode. You know, I remember calling home and mum was in bits on the phone, and I heard like the sort of strength in her voice just fading away every time I spoke to her. Just feeling completely helpless, really.
So let me just get this straight. You're on the mountain for 2 days. And what's the scene like? Are you covered in snow? Are you?
No, it was just fairly
purely stuck.
Yeah, it was fairly intact. It was in a spectacular place to be. You know, don't get me wrong. Yeah. I mean, Camp One is you're surrounded by these sort of 7,000 meter peaks on either side of you. It's like being in a film. Wow. I mean, you know, for those who actually see this, you know, you see a lot, you know, on my virtual background, this is the mountain Choayu, which is 8,000 meters, but it looks similar to that. You know, it's just spectacular. I mean, there's pictures of it on my website and in my book as well. But it's, yeah, I mean, it was certainly intact. I mean, luckily the tents have survived. We were all unharmed, but we're just sort of cut off from the outside world. The route to base camp had gone, kind of been wiped out, was unsafe. So no, we were quite, we're fine, really. We're just working out what the hell do we do now? Mm. You know, how do we get off this thing?
And the aftermath is, I could presume, crazy. chaos, bring you down from the mountain, and or well, they don't let you go forward, right? They say, okay, come back to base camp. And obviously, as you described, it was like a plane crash. I would imagine, having only spoken to Alex Danforth now for about an hour, give or take, on and off this podcast too, you would have been really pissed off that you'd failed. Yes, obviously it's tragic that people have died, but the now realization that you haven't been able to summit Everest is probably hitting home, and I can imagine there's a whole range of emotions that are about to kick off, right?
At the time, to be honest, I didn't care about the mountain. I didn't care about failure. I was just grateful to be alive. I didn't,
right.
To be honest, I was in survival mode. I didn't really know what was going on. You know, I didn't want to be anywhere. I didn't want to be home. I didn't want to be on the mountain. I just didn't know where I wanted to be. There was no anger. There was no disappointment. You know, we got to base camp and just see the devastation. You know, everything was just gone. We were in kind of, you know, we managed to salvage in tents, but you're in like a bomb blast, you know, and you just, kind of in survival mode. You don't really realize what's going on. You don't really process the emotions until I was in the airport on the way home, and that's when I just broke down. And then getting home was just awful. It really was a sense of guilt, you know.
What do you mean guilt?
I think when 22 people had died, you know, and most of them had been in, well, everyone at base camp, everyone on the mountain was fine, but at base camp, the people, well, the three in our team, and then most of the teams around our tents, had we not left base camp at 5 o'clock that morning, you know, chances are we'll be speaking to you now. That's the sort of guilt, the kind of why them, why not me mentality, really.
Mm. Have you had time to reflect back on that?
Years later, I mean, I think I'm probably still subconsciously dealing with that. The depression, anxiety was always there before that, so it wasn't triggered by that by any means, but I think it's definitely driven by it in some way. At the time, my response was just, what can I do to help? You know, can I do something positive? The only way to cope with it was to try and make a difference. So that was when I started fundraising, and I started on my first book, Icefall, which was kind of therapeutic, almost to relive it and get it on paper. But in terms of like speaking about it, I mean, I was already starting to speak in public and companies and schools by that point, but it was a few months before I could manage it because it was so raw. But writing and charity events, you know, gave me a focus. It wasn't enough. You know, at the end of that year, I hit a really bad depression. When even running, I couldn't even motivate myself to get out and run. Like, I did a half marathon. Well, I entered a half marathon, and literally halfway through, I just binned it. I just broke down and just walked home, which is really, was for me, was a real sign as to how bad things were, because I knew I could run a half marathon. I mean, I'd run marathons just for the hell of it. But that was when I kind of first accepted and asked for help, was the end of that year, because I realized this was worse than I'd ever dealt with.
And what was the emotions associated with it? I mean, I'm just trying to work out why you were fighting depression at that time. What was the trigger?
It wasn't so much a disappointment about what had happened with Everest. It was, I just finished my first book, which had probably given me a focus, a distraction.
Mm.
I did a challenge called Everesting. So I thought, okay, sod this. If I can't climb it, I'm going to cycle it, which raised some money for Everest, which raised some money for the people in Nepal. So just means cycle up and down a hill, 29,000 feet, same height of Everest in under 24 hours. I did that, but when that had gone, there's this void. And that's when it forced me to confront it. Combined with that, it was the winter. I've always had low mood in winter, more so than summer. I've just been kind of prone to that. It almost kind of, it's kind of a trigger point. It was just that loss of purpose, like not having a goal to work towards anymore, was the challenge, really. And that's when I started to have to confront things again. But even I was speaking in public again, and even just like cycling to events, it was just like to find the motivation had just disappeared. So it was just this sense of just numbness, really, emptiness. And
was there a loss of identity as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. There's loss of purpose and identity for sure.
You then did another extraordinary challenge with Climb the UK, which to any I'd say I hate to categorize this as normal, but we would never think, okay, well, let me climb to the highest point of every UK county in one go, running, walking, cycling through each peak, which is an extraordinary challenge in itself.
Actually, before that, to kind of get me out of this rut as such, I went back to the Himalayas in the end of 2016 to try and climb the sixth highest peak in the world, which is Chowayu in Tibet. And this was for me a bit of closure. It was a chance to get some experience before my plan was to go back to Everest in 2017.
Mm.
But on that mountain, there was no real disaster this time. I just suffered on the altitude and got to 7,200 meters, got to the actual summit attempt for once, got very, very close. It was a brilliant trip. I loved it. But then the altitude just hit me. And despite being the youngest and, probably the most trained on the team, I was by far the weakest. I just couldn't acclimatize. I've never been very good at altitude. So I had to, abandon the summit attempts with, possible high altitude cerebral edema, which can be quite serious, nasty. So obviously I was, I was out of there. I was heading down.
Mm. What does that feel like?
At the time, it was bitter. It was bitter. But it was also a lesson than not to give up too soon, because I'd been very nearly evacuated because I was so ill in the first 2 weeks before we even got to base camp. My blood oxygen was something like 54%, and my base camp manager saw it and just went, shit, man, he just panicked.
Yeah.
because it was so dangerously low. But with a bit more time, I recovered and I came flying back up the hill. I was super strong. I just needed more time. And I was there thinking, it's all over, Everest is off, what am I going to do with myself? My life's pointless. There is that almost that fear of like being suicidal, thinking, crikey, what is my life going to be without this? But then 2 weeks later, I'm at camp one feeling, come on, let's go and, let's go and do this. And that was a lesson for me, but in itself, actually, it was a really key moment on the journey, probably the most important moment, because I looked back at Everest on the way home and it's like that calling wasn't there. That feeling that I'd had for so long had just disappeared. And it wasn't a case of giving up, but it was a case of, had I been in that tent the year before, that was just torn apart, buried under a foot of ice at Rocket Base Camp. What would I have left behind? And a sense of, am I really ever going to be happy or satisfied? Because we're always chasing that next big thing, that next summit. But then we never quite get there. Then we always want more and more and more. It's like people buy nice cars, or they go and, they buy a nice house or get a kind of perfect job, and they never really seem that satisfied. I think Everest for me was going to be the same way. And I realized I had nothing to prove anymore, I started to think, well, what can I do to make a difference close to home? And that's when the idea for the next challenge, which was Climb the UK, started. and actually became my whole new Everest. You know, it gave me that sort of summit day that I'd never had, and was so much more rewarding and enjoyable in many ways. So yeah, it took a completely different journey, and I think a sense of self-acceptance as well.
What are the actual logistics of climbing the UK? Because you did it in one go, right? Which is mind-boggling. But yeah, you climbed to the highest point of every UK county in one go. So essentially, you were running, walking, cycling through and beyond each peak.
Yeah.
Am I correct? Yeah.
Yeah, mostly cycling, actually. And then there was even a bit of kayaking to the Isle of Wight. I wanted to make it as possible. Obviously, I hired a mountain bike on the island and got my one and only flat tire of the entire 5,000 miles. But yeah, I mean, logistically, it was a massive headache. There was months and months and months of planning, but it took me a long time to get to that point of having the challenge. You know, you almost have this criteria, like, it's got to do this, and this. I knew I wanted to support, you know, a cause, I think, based on mental health, because I'd realised just how long it took me to get any NHS support. And by the time it did, I'd kind of sorted myself out for having another challenge. And so I knew I wanted to do that. And it took me till probably January that year to actually have the idea and have those goosebumps and think, right, that's the goal. I've got the vision. Let's do it. And then I had a very hectic few months getting ready for that, you know. So it took a lot of looking at maps on ViewRanger, on Strava, and then you've got to look for accommodation. Then you've got to look for, you know, trying to stay in places where there's going to be interest with people supporting me, and you know, schools I can speak at, where there's media participation, where there's people who can come in and walk with me. What's the best way around it? You know, there's some hills in the middle of Scotland that there's only one way in, and just, it was minefields, you know, so much researching, but I enjoyed that process. You know, that's the really rewarding part of it. I had this very convoluted map around the UK and all logistics and schedule. And obviously all that then goes to pot when something, things don't go to plan. Day five, I'd strained a muscle in my quad. So I was in agony for 3 weeks, and that knocked me behind schedule. I then had a chest infection. So I lost a few days there. I was having to really readjust things. And you just have to adapt and overcome. You know, you have to make a plan B. And I think that's a good thing for mental health as well, is sometimes just accepting it one day at a time. But yeah, it was quite literally the highs and the lows of the UK, and got me to realise that we have an amazing country to explore that a lot of us, including myself, haven't really experienced.
Very, very interesting. Your mind's ability to process resilience is amazing. And I like to understand, like, the kind of mental process that you would go through when faced with resilience. Because for a lot of people listening or watching, and for me personally as well, sometimes if we're faced with scenarios or situations which require resilience, we kind of just give in. But there's a different psychology that plays out in your mind in the process. So take me back to a time where actually you have needed to go through this process in your mind and be resilient, and actually how that unfolds.
I think I've almost found myself without any other real choice, because I've created that accountability towards a goal, and for me to give into that challenge goes against experience and ethos, and I know I'm capable of overcoming that. I don't want to settle for anything less than that, and therefore I just have to confront it, I think, because I'd have to deal with the kind of almost the kind of low confidence and self-worth of knowing I gave up too soon. But also there are situations like Everest and the Avalanche when I literally had no choice but to deal with it. And I think that's when you really learn a lot about yourself and what you're capable of. And I think sometimes you're always kind of pushing the bar and pushing the bar. And sometimes it pushes too far. And then I've had a few blowouts on the mountains and I've been sat there crying my eyes out, you know, but it's all got too much.
Thinking, why the fuck am I doing this?
And that makes it easier next time. You know, you're able to tolerate more. But I think it's always about, okay, what can I control? What can I do? How can I make the best of this? The initial stage is always horrible. Like with my challenge at the moment, you know, having an injury setback, the first few days I'm in a rage. I'm just full of negative energy and I have to let that out. You've got to, you know, it's okay to not feel okay. It's okay to be miffed and annoyed and upset. And that's all part of the grieving process. But the sooner you can kind of accept that, the sooner you can move on.
Mm.
And yeah, it's just about, okay, what can I do next? And it might be something really small, you know, but it's about actually, I'm not being, you know, stopped by this or, you know, or beaten by this. But I think as well, there is that element of when I'm doing a challenge that perhaps scares me or, you know, I don't want to do, I kind of subconsciously throw myself in the deep end, as I call it, where you create a situation where you have no choice but to swim. I think that's a really good way to live a really rewarding life, because you really discover sort of how far you can go.
Fascinating. Your training, or well, you've had to push back your Three Peaks run, which is running. What is the Three Peaks run? I don't want to get it wrong. You're running sure. Between. So,
the challenge that I had planned for this year was obviously meant to happen early in the year, but obviously couldn't because of the lockdown and everything else. Was the National Three Peaks on a run. So I was going to climb Ben Nevis, Scarf, or Pike and Snowdon, but running the entire distance. So it's about 440 miles in 9 days, which will be the fastest known time if successful. The Three Peaks was my first challenge many years ago, and I've got more and more into running, especially since I moved up in the South Lakes last year. Running has definitely been my passion, and it made sense to do another UK-based challenge because climbing UK was just so rewarding in that sense.
Mm.
So I came up with this idea. But naturally, you know, it's been one setback after another, and I was due to start early August, and, you know, my ankles decided otherwise. So I'm currently trying to keep hold of the goal. You know, it's very frustrating because people think, oh, I'll just do it next year. But you've got yourself physically, mentally prepared, and you're afraid of the goal. You're visualizing it, and it's been pushed further and further away. And there's only so much resilience you've got to chase that. So at the moment, yeah, I'm just trying to deal with that as best I can. But yeah, all being well. Well, it's not if, it's when. That will be starting. And it will be probably the hardest challenge I've ever done. You know, I'm more of a road runner by background. I'm very new to ultra running, but I've kind of always been that way. I've never been very good at any sport. I've just kind of thrown myself in the deep end, and after climbing the UK, I know what I can get through, and I'm really keen to push myself and see what I can do with this.
You started the podcast saying that you've been struggling with your mental health, and actually before we started recording, you said that this is a timely podcast because you were currently in your own rut at the moment. That is because obviously you're, I presume, beating yourself up about the fact that you're not able to achieve what you want to achieve with the start time of the run and get it done. What does the daily battle, what are the kind of, what are the battles in your mind right now? How is that playing out day to day?
I think it's the loss of control again. I mean, we all like to be in control. I think when people don't have agency over their lives, you know, whether that could be caused by something else, it could be, you know, I'm sure by something a lot worse than just a challenge, you know, people that have lost loved ones, or they've lost a job, or they've lost their home, or, you know, something like that, which of course is a lot more significant than me choosing to do a challenge that I don't need to do. That whole sense of loss of agency, I think, is a real problem, I think, with mental health across the country. That's where people might resort to, you know, unhealthy ways to cope, whether that's alcohol or, you know, binge eating or, you know, violence or anything else. And for me, it's always been through exercise. But obviously, when you take away that option through an injury, it's you've got a bit of a perfect storm. At the moment, there's a mix of things. I mean, obviously, there's expectation, there's pressure, because I've had a lot of people who have very, very kindly, you know, sponsored me. You know, they put their faith and belief in me. And I feel this is my opportunity to achieve something for myself as well as, you know, as well as others. And that after lockdown and everything else, we've all had our goals and plans thrown away. And for me, being able to achieve is really important for my self-worth, you know, and just being able to get out and run, to have that ability, that escape, and you know, not to be able to have that, I think is very frustrating, because it's similar to the challenges I've had in the past. You know, it's you know, people say, oh, you know, go and just do something else, but this is a different part of me and who I am. And I know it's only temporary, but again, the anxiety can convince you everything. You know, you can read something that tells you you're not going to run for 6 months, and you're like, what? And so yeah, it is just that frustration, and then not having an outlet for that frustration is when things can become unhealthy and unhelpful. You know, and as well, not being able to have the answers. It's not like, okay, I can definitely do it in X number of days, because then you can segment it. But it's that uncertainty of, right, in 10 days' time, I may not be able to do it because the injury may not be sorted or something like that. And I think it's just getting yourself psyched up, and then suddenly it's like Christmas, suddenly becomes a month later. Mm. You know, you're constantly jumping and jumping and jumping, and then your energy and your fear levels suddenly are just crashing and burning all the time. But I think it's that sense of like self-worth, not being able to do something that is important to me, and that I've invested a lot of training and effort and time into, you become very much a victim again. And obviously I should know better. I've dealt with this many, many times before, and therefore I know I can deal with it again. But as I said, it's still okay to struggle with it.
Absolutely. I'm very, very grateful for you saying that, because a lot of people are going to be like, here's a guy who has already achieved so much, and yet he's 25. And he is so openly talking about the struggles he's dealing with day to day. So hats off to you. Five questions now that I ask people on the rut. Number one, what's your favorite book and why?
Well, of course, I can't say my books, can I?
No.
I probably listen to books more than read them now when I'm on my long runs, just about the time. It's hard to say I've got a favourite, but I think one of the most influential books was Mud, Sweat and Tears by Bear Grylls. And just that story of how he broke his back when he was, just before he climbed Everest when he was 23, actually gave me the confidence that I needed to keep on going, to hold on to my dream when I had that injury before Everest. Because ultimately that injury is actually what inspired me to set the date and say, right, in 2014, I'm going to attempt Everest, which was a bizarre, ridiculous choice, but actually it gave me that hope. So I think that book will always have a special place in my heart. And I was always very grateful that he actually endorsed my first book, Icefall, as well. So I was really chuffed with that. And recently, during lockdown, I read a book by David Goggins, you know, Can't Hurt Me. Not everybody's cup of tea, but he was running ultramarathons on stress fractures and all sorts of physical conditions. And while I wouldn't advocate that, I think recently with my injuries, it started to make me question my limits a bit more as well. So that was quite a good read.
Very interesting. Number two, what lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
Well, anyone will tell me, like any friends and mentors will tell me, I'm very, very impatient. And I think to not rush things, I think I can do more in the time than I really have. And having a realistic idea of timing, I think, is a constant challenge. So I think it's that case of, you know, there will always, I think just being able to accept that enough is enough. I never want to settle for average. I think I've had to accept what's realistic. So I guess it's that idea of there is still time. I have a perception that that time is running out. But after Everest, I've realised how fragile life can be. So it's just having time, you know, really, I think, is one of the main ones.
Fascinating. Your friend, who's having a very tough time at the moment, picks up the phone, rings you, and says that he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
it's interesting, isn't it? We're always very good at giving advice, not taking it ourselves. I think I'd always say that just get through the next day. A lot can change in a day. You know, your whole mindset can shift with a decent sleep. You know, doing some, taking an action step. I think doing something positive. It can be something small, like just going for a run, or, you know, going outside for a walk, or just reading a book, sending an email, writing a blog. I think writing for me has always been really key, just to put your feelings down rather than carrying them in your head.
Absolutely.
So I think expression is the opposite of depression. So expressing yourself in however way you can, and not worrying about what's going to happen in a week or a month or a year, because it probably won't.
Yeah, I love that. I hope you don't mind me trademarking that expression is the opposite of depression.
I read it somewhere else. I can't claim it as my own.
Fantastic. So you've plagiarized as well. Happy days. Because that,
all, you know, sharing is caring. But I read it in a really good book myself, actually.
That's fantastic. I love that. When you're struggling with something, obviously case in point at the moment, which is, again, a timely pod, you're struggling with yourself. What's your go-to? Like, who, what, where do you turn to?
Running in the hills at sunrise is my magic place. And obviously, real shame when I can't do that because of, you know, injuries or conditions or something else. Getting in to see the sunrise from a mountain for me is just puts my soul at rest. It's just magic. I can't explain it. And this is kind of why I moved up nearer to the lakes, to be able to do that more often. I try and do it at least once a week. So I think, yeah, just generally getting out in the hills on a run is my happy place. I've always had a very kind of close sort of support circle of friends and family. And I think, as much as sometimes they don't understand, I think sometimes venting to them, having a call, can really change my outlook as well. I think it's just being able just to not be afraid to be negative. Don't have this sensation that, you know, because you're this and that, that you should be positive all the time. I think we're all okay to have a vent.
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, obviously talking is on the podcast, before we move into question five, but on this podcast is about getting men to talk. It's good that you obviously endorse that, but talking has saved my life, and, you know, I'm sure in many ways it's saved your life at certain points, which is amazing. I mean, it's can't stress it enough. Gotta talk about the smallest little things.
I think don't assume anything. You know, you might think people are going to say the same things and you might not want to speak, but then afterwards you think, crikey, why didn't I do that sooner? It's a catch-22, but it's also people saying the right things to us. You know, people that try and fix. Sometimes they just need to listen.
Question five, and last question. You're lying on your deathbed looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
Oh, crikey. I think it's about leaving something bigger behind. You know, the challenges and adventures are great for us, and we need them for ourselves. But I think it's how the way we respond to the challenges and setbacks, I think, are what really shape us. And I think the whole Everest journey, I think, for me is probably what I'm most proud of. But just to be able to keep on going where I am today, you know, I've not done anywhere near what I want to or as much as I should have done. But I think I'm always going to be in that mindset. I think, just the ability to keep on going when I was so close to giving up so many times.
Fantastic. Alex, I can't thank you enough for the hour and 10 minutes you've given up here. It's been incredibly fascinating. I said I'd definitely let you go by 6:30. So we're going to do that. But thank you so, so much for exploring a different side of the rut with me. It's been amazing.
I mean, time's flown by. So that's always a good sign. And hopefully everybody else has not found it's dragged on too long. I think, it's a real honour to have the chance to talk about these things. As you say, it saves lives, and great to be doing it more often. You know, we all need to do it. I think it only takes one person to share their story, and then other people can share theirs. So thank you for giving us the platform.
No problem. Alex, thanks, mate.
See you again.